This podcast is Challenging Opinions and is presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading the Challenging Opinions podcast for October 16th, 2017. My guest in this podcast is a former CIA operative who spent time on assignment in dozens of countries around the world. In the first part of this interview, we'll talk about why he joined and then left the CIA.
Challenging Opinions is the podcast where ideas are tested. Whether you are left or right, conservative or progressive, devout or skeptic, what matters is the strength of your argument, not the strength of your voice.
On the line now, I have John Kiriakou. I have had a convicted felon on the podcast before, but I don't think I've ever had a spy on the podcast before. John, why did you join the CIA?
Oh, I joined the CIA for a couple of reasons. I was intensely patriotic. I grew up in an immigrant household. My grandparents all came from Greece, from the island of Rhodes, and were very grateful to this country for the opportunities that it had provided them. And so public service was always a very important thing in our family. So patriotism was one reason. And another is I really wanted to see the world. Mm-hmm. And thought that would be an exciting way to do it. And certainly it was. I've been to nearly 70 countries, almost all of those with the CIA, and got to do things most Americans can only dream of.
And when you were in the CIA, can you pinpoint the first moment that you felt that motivation wasn't enough for what you were doing?
Oh, I can give you the exact date. It was May the 22nd, 2002.
What happened?
I had returned from Pakistan, where I was the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations. And we had captured, I'm not allowed to say the exact number, but we had captured many dozens of Al-Qaeda fighters who had come across the border from Afghanistan and were hiding in safe houses. We captured Abu Zubaydah, who we believed at the time was the number three in Al-Qaeda, and these dozens and dozens of other fighters with him. When I returned to headquarters in May, I was in the cafeteria and a senior officer from the CIA's counterterrorism center approached me and congratulated me on what I had done in Pakistan and then asked if I wanted to be, his words, certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. Well, I had never heard that term before and I asked him what he meant. And he delineated these torture techniques for me.
Which were?
Well, beginning with called the attention grasp, grabbing somebody by the lapels. I mean, that's not really torture, but culminating then in waterboarding, in sleep deprivation, in a cold cell, all of this done while the prisoner's nude and shackled and kept in stress positions. And to make a long story short, I believed this was a torture program.
And John, tell me why you felt joining the CIA was a good idea, but this was a bad idea.
Well, you're making an assumption in that question that the CIA was always engaged in this kind of behavior. Things really did change after the Reagan administration. You know, starting in 1975, we had real oversight on Capitol Hill. We had members of the House and Senate intelligence committees that really did keep the CIA on a short leash. And things started getting better in 1975. President Ford outlawed CIA assassinations with Executive Order 12333. And then things really got good during the Clinton presidency, where the CIA actually went through something called a cull. They went through the files of literally every source who had been recruited and then severed their relationships with any source who had any history of violence or any human rights problems in his past. So things really were getting better. Everything changed back again for the worse on September 11th.
Let's go just to a different September 11th, which was also a Tuesday. In 1973, on the 11th of September, there was a coup in Chile, which was essentially engineered by the CIA. You had to have been aware of that.
Of course.
How, okay, maybe they didn't murder people, but they probably did. But how was violently overthrowing a democratically elected government, how was that an expression of patriotism?
Well, again, you're not listening to me. That was 1973. Mm-hmm. There were congressional hearings in 1975. Things began to change for the better in 1975. By the time I joined the CIA in 1990, there was real oversight and there was real concern for human rights.
Sure, but you must have been aware that it was likely to go to ebb and flow, and that when somebody else was in the White House, the influence would go in a different direction.
Well, I wish I had had a crystal ball, but I didn't. I believed in congressional oversight.
And then for people who don't know your story, tell the story of how you left the CIA and ended up in prison.
Well, I left the CIA. You know how when people resign from a job, they say that they're leaving to spend more time with their families. I actually left the CIA so I could spend more time with my family. I was divorced. I had two young sons. I was looking at another tour in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iraq, and I just decided that my boys needed me more than the CIA did, and I resigned. 3 years later, though, I gave a nationally televised interview to ABC News in which I confirmed that the CIA was torturing its prisoners, an act that I believed to be illegal, mm-hmm. besides being immoral and unethical. But I said three things in that interview. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. And I said that the policy had been personally approved by the president. So within 24 hours, the FBI began investigating me. They investigated me from December of 2007 until December of 2008. And in December 2008, they decided that I had not committed a crime and they closed the case. But 4 weeks later, when Barack Obama was inaugurated as president, the CIA asked him to secretly reopen the case against me. His attorney general, Eric Holder, did exactly that. I was investigated for three more years until January of 2012, and then finally charged with five felonies coming out of that ABC News interview, including mm-hmm. three counts of espionage.
And you took a plea deal, is that correct?
Yeah, I took a plea deal to a lesser charge. I mean, this becomes an economic decision. What the government does is something called charge stacking, where they'll charge you with 5, 10, 20 felonies, and they'll wait until you go bankrupt, and then they'll come back and say, all right, we'll dismiss all the charges but one if you take a plea. Well, I was facing 45 years in prison. I believed I was innocent, mm-hmm. but they offered me 30 months, of which I would serve 23. Mm-hmm. And knowing that the government wins, according to ProPublica, 98.2% of its cases, do you throw the dice and face 45 years or do you take the deal? Well, everybody takes the deal. And that's what I did.
Tell us about life in prison. You wrote a book, I should say, which is called Doing Time Like a Spy, which about how the CIA taught your life in the CIA taught you how to survive prison.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, in sentencing, my attorneys asked the judge to send me to a minimum security work camp. And the prosecution agreed and the judge agreed. And so I was ordered to go to a work camp. Now, in a work camp, there are no bars on the windows. There are no fences. The doors are kept unlocked. You're free to come and go as you please. You're just on your honor not to abscond. And so when I got to the prison to turn myself in, I went to the minimum security camp and they referred me to the prison across the street where I had to check in. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I was put through a metal detector. And finally, the corrections officer began leading me around to the back of the actual prison. And I said, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp across the street. And he chuckled and said, not according to my paperwork, you're not. So I told myself just to take it easy. There's nothing you can do. If you make a scene, they'll put you in solitary. So I just went along with it. And then it took me 5 days before I could get access to a telephone. So when I did, I called my attorney and I said, hey, they put me in the actual prison. What do I do? And he said, oh my God, well, we could file a motion, but it'll be 2 years before we get a hearing and you'll be home by then. He said, I'm sorry, buddy. You're just going to have to tough it out. And so I made a conscious decision to rely on my CIA training to keep myself safe and at the top of the social heap there.
Just before you tell us about that, do you think that was something that was maliciously done? You said to this by who?
Absolutely. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request on myself to try to get to the bottom of this. And the person who processed my request made a mistake and included 8 documents that were stamped FOIA exempt, do not release to inmate. The one that was the most important was in huge block letters. And it said, caution, inmate has access to the media. And that was the bottom line. They thought that if they locked me up in the actual prison, that I wouldn't have access to the media. Well, I had begun writing a blog from prison that was carried on a variety of websites, including the Huffington Post. I garnered millions of hits. I won the Penn First Amendment Award, one of the 4 most important literary awards in America for this blog series, and it became this book. And so I was far more a thorn in the side of the Bureau of Prisons in the prison than I ever would have been in the camp.
You reckon they made a mistake?
They made a mistake, and I made them pay for it.
I want to move on from that. Just tell us briefly about how you survived, what it was like day to day being in a prison, what the other prisoners were like, how you treated them, how they treated you.
That's a good question. And it's a hard one to answer because you have to constantly do a dance. One of the things that the CIA taught me to do was to make strategic alliances. Now I was in shock that very first day, so I wasn't really thinking about my training that first day. And when I was processed into the prison, the only thing that the corrections officer said to me was, if someone comes into your cell uninvited, that's an act of aggression. And I thought, great, I've been here 45 minutes and I'm going to get my ass kicked. And so I got to my cell, I was sitting there, and sure enough, 2 neo-Nazis walked right into my cell. One had an enormous swastika tattoo that took up the entire front half of his neck. So I jumped up and I put up my fists and I said, what do you want? And the next swastika guy said, take it easy. Are you the new guy? And I said, yeah, so? And he said, are you a fag? And I said, no. Are you a rat? And I said, no, I'm not a rat. I didn't have anybody else in my case. And he said, are you a chomo? I said, I don't know what that word means. And like I was stupid, he said, chomo, child molester.
Uh-huh.
And I said, of course I'm not a child molester. And he said, okay, you can sit with the Aryans at our table in the cafeteria. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm with the Aryans now. A few days later, 2 young, very solidly built African-American men walked into my cell, one holding a newspaper. And again, I jumped up and put my fists up. And one of them very gingerly handed me the paper and said, take it easy. Are you the CIA guy? And I said, yeah, so what about it? And he said, Reverend Farrakhan says you're a hero of the Muslim people. And we wanted to tell you that you're not going to have any trouble with us. And then I thanked him. And he handed me this paper, and it was the Nation of Islam's newspaper, and it was an interview with Louis Farrakhan in which he mentions me. So besides those 2 incidents, 4 of my 5 cellmates in that original cell were members of 4 different Mexican drug gangs, the Norteños, the Borrachos, the Mexican Mafia, and I forget what the other one was. And one of them asked me if I was educated, and I said that I was, and he asked if I would write an appeal for him to appeal his sentence. And I said, sure. He said, well, how much will you charge me? And I said, oh, I've got friends on the outside who put money in my account. I'm not going to charge you anything. I'll do it just because I have nothing else to do. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to write a legal appeal. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this appeal, and he very discreetly put the word around among the Mexicans, who were by far the most dangerous contingent in the prison, that I was a good guy. And so I never had any problem with the Mexicans. Finally, after several months, I lived across the hall from a senior captain in the Bonanno crime family. And several months after I got there, he pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, let me ask you a question." And I should preface this by saying I really liked this guy. I would give him my New York Times and he would give me his New York Post, and we would sit and chat and watch TV together. I liked him a lot. And he said, "Let me ask you a question. Why do you sit with those Nazi retards in the cafeteria?" And I said, "I don't know. My first day here, they told me to sit with them." And very dramatically, he put his finger in the air and he says, "From today, you're with the Italians." And so from then on, I sat with the Italians, and they were my closest friends. We socialized together. We ate together. We exercised together. We did everything together. And when I say Italians, I mean Italians named Gambino, Bonanno, Lucchese. You get the idea.
I think that's very interesting. And tell me just briefly how life has been. When were you released, and how has life been since then?
I was denied any early release because of the blog series that I was writing. It was a way to punish me for my exercise of my constitutional rights to freedom of speech. And when the warden threatened me, I laughed at him and I said, "Warden, with all due respect, I have gone nose to nose with Al-Qaeda, with Hezbollah, with the Iranians, and I'm supposed to be afraid of you and your prison?" I said, "Please, give me a little bit of credit. I have a short sentence. I'm going home, and there's nothing you can do to stop me." And so even though I had to do the whole stretch, I got out February 3rd, 2015.
To be clear, you were sentenced to 30 months, of which you were supposed to serve 23, but you had to do the full 30. Is that right?
No. They can't take away good time, good behavior. And how should I say this? I had earned 90 days of house arrest, which is a law. They can't take that away from you. What they could take away from you is halfway house time. And I was eligible for as much as 12 months of halfway house time. Mm-hmm. So where I could have actually only done 11 months, I ended up doing 23 months. But, 23 months in prison, 23 months in a halfway house, it's the same difference. And so I wrote this book. I wrote it by hand, longhand. Every once in a while, the cops would raid my cell and they would find my pages that I had written, and they would tear them up and destroy them and step on pictures of my kids and throw my food on the floor. So what I would do is every time I would get 10 pages down on paper, I would seal it up in an envelope and send it to my attorney, because they're not allowed to open legal mail. Mm-hmm. And then my attorney would send it to my wife. And that became the book.
I want to move on to a different area, because I know that you have a lot of expertise, particularly in South Asia and Afghanistan and Pakistan and so forth. One question that really I think a lot of people in the US have not yet answered: is Pakistan an ally of the US?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I personally have...
Never miss a show. You can subscribe to the podcast for free using iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast software or app. See challengingopinions.com/subscribe for details.
If you want to hear John's answer to that question and lots more about his views on Central Asia, the CIA's tactics, and US foreign policy in general, you'll have to wait until next week, because I'm going to run the second part of the interview then. So that's all for the Challenging Opinions podcast, published on October 16th, 2017. I have got links to John's books and references for other things we mentioned in the podcast notes that you can find on the website. And as always, if you know somebody who you think I should interview or some topic that I should cover, I'd be very interested to hear your feedback. If you like the podcast, there's one thing that you could do that would help other people to find it. Go onto iTunes, give the podcast a rating, and write a short review. There's a link on the website directly to the iTunes page. Also, please like the show on Facebook. On Twitter, you can follow the show @ challengingo. You can also follow John Kiriakou at John Kiriakou. And most importantly, subscribe to the show for free. You can use Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app or software. There's links and an RSS feed on the website. And if you don't use a podcast app or software, you can subscribe by email. Just enter your email address on the website and you'll get one little email with an alert each time a new podcast goes up. But no spam, I promise. You can find all of that or get in touch with me at www.challengingopinions.com. Coming up next Monday, that's October 23rd, I'll have the second part of that interview with John Kiriakou, and we'll be talking particularly about his views on Pakistan and what the CIA is doing right and doing wrong in its operations around the world. The Challenging Opinions podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.